I'd like to introduce Canon Sandra Tucker Carmichael of Thompson House, an ecumenical center with the Episcopal and Presbyterian churches for examination of various media of communication with people in our culture, keeping the charismatic concerns of the church in mind. Canon Carmichael also might be called the canon of culture at Christ Church Cathedral, where he preaches regularly. He has a multiplicity of tasks. Today we're going to ask him to speak particularly on the dimension of the theater as it strives to deal with the inner man and this man's relationship to God. We're happy to have you here. We hope that you will feel free to make yourselves at home. And although we had thought we would have a very informal setting in a smaller room, let's keep this informal. Without further ado, Canon Carmichael, we'll knock off a little bit after 12. Perhaps we could leave some time for discussion before then.
I set your cue. And in this amphitheater, I feel much like somebody being thrown to the lions. I recall from my own seminary days that there was never a time when I knew more than I did when I was a middler or a senior. And I suppose that this is true here, so allow me to share my ignorance with you. I speak as a fool, knowing that you'd be wise. However, I speak with eagerness and conviction and gratitude for this opportunity to concern you with some of my concerns. I'm a sort of a chart guy and scribble on the blackboard. Also, I found that in lecturing, if I make a moving target, it's harder for people to hit me. So if I bounce around like a flea on a hot griddle, forgive me. It's just that I'm nervous. That's what I am. Hey, arise from the Greek word theos, having to do as with God and with men. Theater, understandable to me, perhaps best in terms of the closing line of the play, Greek prison, which the final scene is the enterprise of exploration into God. And I suppose that this characterizes the theological enterprise in our time. A time of skepticism, a time in which the gods are scientific in nature, and the truths of faith are not given much credence or validity as those pragmatic data which can be validated in test tubes or off the scale. However, the basic enterprise of theater in our time is essentially that which it has always been. And I can share my understanding of what it has always been, and it is now perhaps best in tracing in very brief perspective what my understanding of theater is. I'm far removed, as you are, culturally, from my prehistorical ancestors. And yet, as a man, I'm emotionally, depthfully involved in the business of trying to make sense out of this brief span of days and years, which I will share on the steaming anthill of the globe. I have a sense of identification with my prehistorical ancestors that I cannot long deny. What sort of man was he? What sort of man am I? In the first and basic instance, my life is spent in trying to plumb the mystery of myself as a man, free, responsible, self-determining, trying to get all of the business of living, organizing my life around some structure of values, attempting to perform acts with some meaning and relevance on the basis of some loyalty, some commitment to a source of values, if we can quote that square-headed old Dutchman up in the Harvard Yard, Paul Tillich, acting upon the ultimate concern of my life, the content of which is my God. I suppose it has always been so for man. And in order to plumb this mystery of himself, his relationship to others, and his relationship to his God, he has had to act it out in order to remind himself of his basic convictions and understandings, in order that he may have a basis of communicating with other people in regard to what these understandings, these values, these concerns, and their meaning really are. I'm not too far removed, nor do I suspect that we, particularly those of us who do our worship, perform our worship within the context of liturgical structures of worship and worship, such as is exemplified within your tradition and within mine. We're a liturgical people. For I am not far removed from the day and age in which men, attempting to plumb and communicate about this mystery, gathered in the myrtle groves around stone altars, and as they spoke as a community, stamped out in ritualistic expression their myth of themselves, their origin, their meaning in the present moment, and their destiny. Such, I believe, was the beginning of all theater. In the sense in which I choose to talk to you about theater at this time, theon, exploration, the enterprise of exploration into God. Now, there came a time, to be sure, when the seeming anthill of the earth became overpopulated, and when the community, the flies, became so large that perhaps it was not feasible for everybody to participate in this dance of life, in this exploration and exploitation of the understandings of the mystery of themselves and their God. So perhaps they appointed individual members of the community to perform this ritual, actually this liturgical act for them. And the people became the beholders. Mind you, I say the beholders, not the spectators. For as they watched this unfolding mystery, this dance, this drama, their participation was compelled. Indeed, their investment in this myth, this reenactment, was every bit as real for them as participating as it had been when perhaps they were dancing themselves. Now let me read over a couple of dozens and maybe even hundreds of centuries to come up to the point of the flowering age of the Greek theater, in which in an amphitheater constructed not unlike the classroom. I've stood on the stadium of the Lord at the theater on the side of the Apocalypse Hill and dropped my nickel to hear that it would be detected up at the top, that perhaps some of you have or will. And this was set up to permit people to do the same kind of thing that our ancestors did in their murder zone. And what will happen then? The people would come not to behold something, not to look at something, to spectate at something, but they were coming to participate in the dramatic presentation of themselves. They were going to the theater to do their agon, that is, to participate in their struggle, the living reenactment of the anguish and the hope and the joy and the purposeful strivings of their lives. And of course, this is where we get the word agony from. It was this serious. And as I will try to demonstrate later, I think that theater in this day and age is of equal seriousness, as is qualified by the kinds of dramatic productions which are now being seen and performed. It mattered not whether the play was Agamemnon or Medea or Oedipus Rex or whatever it was. The people went there in expectation that they were going to see the story of their lives, their agon, their struggle, represented for them, and that they, as participants, would project themselves into this dramatic representation, this reenactment of a chunk of their life, an aspect of their personal and human existence, so that they might, again, participate in the mystery, plumb the mystery of themselves, and seek to discover the mystery of themselves in relationship to their gods. This has always been a distinguishing characteristic of theater, wherever serious theater has been performed. Now let me leap over lightly perhaps 1500 years, coming up to the medieval period and centering on England, the time of the mystery plays, so-called. Mystery has a double meaning here. The word mystery has not only to do with the awesome, the awful, the mysterious, the perplexing, the ultimate truth and reality of which is shrouded in mystery, but in terms of these performances, they can be understood as those performed by the maestros, that is, the guild. The origin of the mystery play, you know as well as I, that began by simple, dramatic, artless, but ultimately artful, representations of certain portions of scripture having to do with the cycle of the Christian year, notably beginning with Easter, as performed within the churches to inaugurate the high festival season of Easter, for instance. Perhaps the simplest one of all is when reenacting the open tomb. Three women processing, seeing the open tomb, performing in pantomime, and this sort of thing. The crowds became such as that they had to be removed from the chancel of the cathedrals or the parish churches out onto the steps of the churches. And finally, in the course of time, whole cycles of these biblical stories, in Old and New Testament, being acted out by the Meisters, the guild of the city, with an all-day procession of clothes in which a simple tableau or in varying degrees of intricacy and complexity, a dramatic representation of some dimension of the mysterious truth about man and his relationship to his God was being offered. The story was being retold before the people in order that they might, to some significant degree, reparticipate in their agon, reparticipate in the myth of this folk, the values by which this folk would attempt to live, the hope of this folk, the struggle of this folk, and the rest. Now, concurrent with the mystery plays, there is also the morality play. And I suppose this is useful for purposes of lecture to illustrate the point that theater always has to do with the interior mode or movement of some people. That is something that is happening inside of a man or a company of men who own some common, share some common humanity, or who participate in some common understanding of past, meaning, function, worth, and direction. Well, you see, the morality plays were, in essence, of the same dimension as the mystery plays. However, they could not resist the temptation to add the hooker, that this, the mystery of it being so, therefore, and Christianity is always a therefore religion, therefore, it behooves you well, or it is incumbent upon you as one who owns this kind of loyalty or professes this kind of value structure to act in such and such a way. Therefore, a moral was drawn. Now, I think that all of us perhaps is fairly clear to this moment. How can I make the leap from historical theater, sketched so briefly, to the theater of our present time? Talk me some plays. What are some plays that kept your attention that have been written within your memory, or perhaps that you've seen? Just give me the name of the play.
Death
of a Sailor.
Something else.
The Comb Ring.
The Comb Ring. Something else. Mister.
Street
Car. To run down the list, and we could check them out individually, are these plays in fairly common knowledge? I suspect that the Tennessee Williams opera is probably more familiar than some of the others. But mind you,
Death of a Salesman,
the Willie Loman,
yes, the success story of Willie Loman,
his agon,
the Streetcar, the Tennessee Williams myth of man, understanding of man, reflection upon man and his present condition, written in somber views perhaps, the essential character of which is tragedy rather than melodrama. Let me make a brief distinction. It won't bear much analysis, but it's useful for conversation. The distinction between tragedy and melodrama, and a melodrama, at any moment in the action of the play, it is possible for the beholders, as well as for the characters in the play itself, to point their finger at the one guy or the one set of circumstances, usually initiated by an individual or by a group of individuals, which is responsible for all the consequent mess and trouble that these folks find themselves in as they perform their play. However, the tragedy is significantly different for conversational purposes. In a tragedy, people out of their agon, their efforts to live as men, men being treated as individuals to live in some kind of community, but men attempting to live as men in community with each other, whether it be interpreted through the fickle action of the gods, or whether it has to do with the essentially tragic posture that men assume in the living and ordering of their lives, find themselves in conflict with each other, the betrayers of their values, unfaithful to the loyalties that they would own, and the rest, and there's a consequent mess. I think that this is a very important point to make, although it will not bear too much critical evaluation as to whether life or theater is to be analyzed as a melodrama, or whether it is the tragedy, which I believe it to be.
Now, where was I when I was carrying on in your question?
Well, first, I was seen by somebody in here, and he picked me up. He's kind of halfway through here, so.
Sir?
The bridge over to the mine.
The bridge to the mine.
Yes.
In essence, what all of the serious drama that is emerging in our time attempts to do is to perform before some people a chunk of their common existence with its tragic complexities by which men may see, understand, be confronted by something that is true about man as man, and may be provided via the agency of a theatrical device, a means, a mode of, again, seeking to form and penetrate the mystery of themselves, the mystery of their communities, and its ultimate consequences in terms of the relationship to the God, who is the ultimate source of the values, by which the people would attempt to understand themselves. Now, another man that I hope that you'll have a chance to talk with sometime, the diamond I know and respect, is Lee Whitson over at your neighboring seminary. Lee and I have done some work together with Lee Garvey and with clergy and with Rachel in regard to the whole function of the arts, because the theatrical arts are included in this general rundown, and anything that I would say about the arts in general will be correspondingly true about the theatrical arts. The canon by which most artistic production, creative effort, is judged is via the canon of taking. I behold something, I see something, I hear something, and I say, I like it or I don't like it. Most people, for reasons that I think you could divine with a readiness equal to my own, never get beyond evaluating and being evaluated by a creative effort of an artist, a dramatist, a poet, a sculptor, a painter, a musician, whatever it may be. Never get beyond the canon of taste. It all stops here. I like it, I don't like it, it pleases me, or it does not please me, it pleases me, it offends. But beneath the canon of taste, and it seems to me that we're beginning to move into the very essence of the nature of the religious enterprise in which you and I, as communicators of religious values and truths, are engaged. Our particular apologia has to do with the canon of truth. Is it true or is it not true? Whether you like it or not. Whether it pleases or not. Whether it titillates the imagination, brings forth a yuck or a chuckle or a throb and a tear. Is it true? There's something about the quality of art, and I'm speaking in general categories, but within the general categories with full validity in regard to the theatrical arts. It is not so much a matter of my going to play in New York, as I hope to go next week, and sitting back and defying the players and the writers and the producers to amuse me, to divert me, to delight me. It is not that I am plucking my hawkers down in a seat as a self-appointed critic on the basis of a canon, like my canon of personal taste or preference to say this is a good play or this is not a good play or that this should continue or this should not continue.
although I must confess that, like most of the rest of the people I know, this is the basis on which I am confronted. So the posture that I assume when I confront an art form, whether it be the Henry Moore stuff out at the airport, or whether it be the Religion and Arts exhibition now in session down at the Art Museum Auditorium, or whether it be the play that I will see in New York, the posture is essentially the same. I am the armchair critic. But something that I've come to discover in the years of my ascendancy, maturity, or perhaps decline, is at the same time, I am looking at it. It is looking at me. It is not that I am a beholder, but that I am being beheld. And at the time I am watching it, it is saying something to me, about me, and about the people with whom I share life, that I must keep very seriously. Why? Again, I have to give you a very brief sketchy lecture in format. I'm worried about it. The very word religion can be a slippery tool for people like you and me as communicators of religious values or understanding. And I don't think it can be appreciated fully, nor can our communication about these values or understandings be communicated effectively until we make allowance for the full range and scope of what this word suggests. And I can illustrate what it suggests only in terms of the possible origins. Well, where is the word religion, from which does it emerge? Quite obviously, it has rooted in the Latin word religio, which literally translated means mystery. All. That which is all. That which has to do with the taboo, this gold, this dust, by which a people attempt to order their life. But by the same token, I cannot deny that it has rootages in the Latin word religare, which in literal translation means to bind up again, to bind back, inferring that something is falling apart, something is collapsing, something is sprawling, and needs to be put back together again. Perhaps this is given, for me, clearest illustration in terms of the L-I-G-A part of portions of this word, ligam. As in the case of ligament, which, as I understand it, is that which connects bone and sinew together in order that a limb may function as it is intended, built, intended to function. For instance, that is a hand, and as you look at it, it has all the outward appearances of a hand. However, until or unless it is properly hooked up with a system of ligaments, it has no capacity to function as a hand out of the very nature of its structure was intended to function. Thus, religion has to do with those hookups within a man or within a community of men which make it possible for them to function in an intended and prescribed manner. Nor can I deny the fact that this L-I-G-A portion of religare suggests to me ligature. If I walk out the door and I fall flat on my head and split my head open, it will probably be, and the blood starts gushing forth. If I start leaking the vital juices of my life that sustain my life, it will be necessary for me to call for Nurse Jane or Dr. Jones to sew it up with a ligature to ligate my wound in order that I don't leak anymore, that I hold together. It's as simple as this. I can understand the functional nature of religion in terms of the agon of man's life, the struggling and the purposeful striving, the creative efforts of a man's life in these ways, perhaps you can as well. But I cannot long deny that perhaps this very word religio must be seriously considered and reckoned with in terms of its origins from the word religare. I've had first and second year Latin, like perhaps you have too, and I remember all about lex legis, law. Religare, literally the re-lawing, the reordering, the restructuring of values and the purposeful efforts of life in order to assume form, shape, definition, purpose. I oftentimes feel that we who have the most earnest and sincere dedication and zeal attempt to be Christian apologists do not reckon seriously enough with the agon that all men, regardless of religious affiliation, profession, are attempting to perform, attempting to make sense out of what oftentimes appears to be the nonsense of it all, attempting to discover some source of values by which and around which a man's life may be ordered, around which a man can, as a result of which a man can perform purposeful, striving, struggling, creative, reaching out efforts to plumb the mystery of himself, to discover a basis on which his life is assumed some shape, form, meaning, and definition, and can only which definitions can only be discovered in terms of his understanding of a faith relationship to an ultimate concern, the content of which is God. Now, this was a departure from talking about what happens when you see a play, or when you look at a piece of a painting or a piece of sculpture or the rest. Beyond the canon of taste, there is the question, is it true? What does it say about me? What does it say about my time? What does it say about the people with whom I share? But more importantly, and this is good for our male as apologists, what does it have to say? What truth does it communicate about theological, religious truth does it communicate about me, about men, in terms of our sin and our separation from the God whom we call our God, our Lord? Or what does it communicate or facilitate our understanding of in terms of his action in the world which all of us, including him, are commonly engaged? This is a big hurdle, or was a big hurdle for me to get over, to understand seriously that this is what the nature of artistic communication is, whichever of the seven lives or forms of the arts we may be dealing with. But it is a vital and necessary one, and it is my own conviction that in terms of cultural communication, in terms of effective, viable communication of those ancient truths and certainties of faith and revelation which we will attempt to communicate with some other people, that these are the most effective tools that we have, not only to identify the nature of questions, religious questions and issues. And I'm using my definition of religion, and which is a fairly broad and comprehensive one. It is true that most of these plays, and the ones that we have assessed from Beckett, the rest of the Arthur Miller, the Tennessee Williams production, and almost anything that hits Broadway, or if it finally ventures out of St. Louis, you know it must be great. But these plays have not so much to do with the communication about truth of God in relationship to his people as they do with the basic questions of human existence as they're commonly encountered. Now, I'm not sure what more I could say that would be useful in terms of general presentation. I think that we've got enough data up here on the board to permit us to talk with each other in regard to some of these things that I've told us. I merely point out that whether the play be a self-conscious religious play, J.B., a sleep of prisoners, Gideon, the sign of Jonah, you could run out the list, and the repertoire is becoming life all the time. Or whether it be plays whose essential religious motif can only be identified as such in terms of the categorical definition of religion which I saw up here on the board. But all of the plays that are more than lighthearted musicals, and even the musical plays are becoming serious plays, they have to do, and again, this is a good closing line, with the closing line of A Sleep of Prison. The enterprise is exploration of the God. But God is ultimately and inevitably and only discoverable within the range and the limits of a common existence commonly shared by some people who are attempting in common to get on with the common business of life. I think this is enough in the way of presentation. I'm getting sick of my sound long voice anyhow. What can we talk about? Yes?
Would you speak quite loudly for the tape, please.
Because it seems to me that most of the lectures that we've attended have been in terms of modern theater, modern drama, or all drama, and the business of religion, which has been readily admitted, was very much a general word. I wondered if you would care to comment concerning drama and Christianity. Christianity being a very specialized form of religion, whose ultimate concern, if you will, is proclamation.
Right. I've spent most of my life lecturing, teaching, preaching, exhorting. I don't know how it is with you, but I find that much of the time I'm devoting most of my efforts to answering questions which nobody's ever asked. And consequently, there's no basis for my communicating with some people in regard to what my concerns are as a career religionist. And there, those people, as people who are engaged in a religious enterprise, to which maybe I have the answer, I have resources, I have something to offer, but I have no basis for communication, because all I'm dealing with is karuma, proclamation. I don't know where they are. What I'm thinking, I guess, is that in terms, my basic job, like yours, is to be a Christian apologist, an effective Christian apologist. Communication takes place through dialogue. That is, I spend most of my life, as I've done for the past 30 minutes, in one-way communication. I've thrown out a whole bunch of attitudes, ideas, prejudices, pet gripes, pet projects, and cues. It's all in one way. My increasing obsession and conviction is that communication does not take place until I discover a basis of establishing a dialogue with you, whereby, in terms of some questions, issues, and concerns which may be present in you, can be touched and countered by, first of all, my identification of and with those concerns and issues as they emerge from your life, your needs, and it is only at this point in the dialogue that anything that I have to say may make any sense to you. It is only at this point in our dialogue that communication takes place. It is only at this juncture in our dialogue that my apologia has relevance to you in terms of where and who you are. I think this is categorically true. What do you think?
I would agree with what you're saying, though. Ultimately, the plays that we are discussing here are not ultimately concerned with our Christian proclamation.
No, but they're taking human life dead serious. You see, in terms of the dialogue, we Christians are not there. We formal religionists, particularly we career religionists, are not the only people that take living a life purposefully, meaningfully, hopefully, creatively, seriously. There is that within the warp and woof, the very fabric and essence of a man's life, which stubbornly persists. I must mean something. I must have an identity. I must have a sense of destiny, of purpose. That the liturgy, they may never say it this way, but that the liturgy of my life must be something. Liturgy, out of the Greek word liturgia.
Watch, I just talk to you distinguished people about baby Greek, I don't know, but I can't resist the temptation for purposes of illustration. Liturgum having to do with New Testament usage, with the work of the church, the worship of the church, and is being recovered increasingly in our own time, and not necessarily out of Marian tradition, what people do out of a sense of loyal response to the claim of beautiful actions by an authority which they recognize as the authority in their lives. One of the things that interests me most about the church in our time is the recovery of the sense of the liturgical movement, the recovery of a sense of liturgy. What's the meaning of our Christian liturgy is? People looking all over the landscape and discovering all sorts of ways, not necessarily Christians or even formally religious type people, but some dramatic structure by which and through which they again
like our ancestors out there in the Myrtle Grove, can act out the story of their life, their understanding of who they are, or what they are, and the rest. I think that this is one of the more encouraging things on the scene of the church. The recovery of the sense of ghost theater, drama, well, this is what liturgy is, the dramatization of the faith understandings that we as the Christian tradition have in regard to ourselves, our purpose, our God, and our responses, but the recovery of the sense of what liturgy and worship are. In a real sense, liturgy, as you and I know it, and our formal liturgies are essentially the same, as a matter of fact, Cranmer had plagiarized from all those square-headed expatriated Lutherans that came rushing across the English Channel when they were kicked out of Germany. But we understand each other, and we talk about the liturgy. The recovery of the sensitivity, the searching and thoughtful appraisal of what is the nature and meaning of this liturgy, is to me one of the most hopeful indications for a possible renewal of the church in terms of its effective relationship and end to and ministry to a world that I've yet discovered. We see what I hear coming out of this liturgical revival. This sense of ecclesiastical theater, if you will. This is perhaps a caricature, but this is what liturgy is. This acting out, this dramatization. It's recovering the basic and traditional understanding that unless the liturgy of the church, as the church gathers for her formal moment of worship, is represented the liturgy of the people of God in the world where they live and work with other people, it may be however lovely and momentarily exhilarating and exalting or oppressive, somehow unrelated to the liturgy of life as it's being performed in the midst of the world. I would say that in terms of, I'm more familiar with these two plays than with any others, that whatever these plays may represent, they represent a particular understanding of some rather meaningless and futile and ultimately illusory understanding of a liturgy of life that people are actually living in the world. But more broadly, they are the articulation, the dramatic presentation of the anguish, the perplexed, the bewildered, the troubled cry of men who won't settle for this kind of life, who are looking for some other liturgical alternative by which life may be ordered, by which life may be given meaning. They serve to articulate the question and the nature of the problem and the issue to which those of us who are charged with the proclamation of a charisma have resources to offer. But our resources, I'm repeating myself, mean very little until we discover a basis of engaging in a serious and earnest giving and taking of a dialogue by which communication between the church and the world is established. I suppose that all I've said is that the arts are the best single tool in the communication of art, the arts. The best single tool that I've yet discovered to facilitate, to enable this kind of dialogue between me and the people of the 20th century under whom I am to minister, under whom I am to proclaim something.
My impression of drama as a means of communication is that people only who are limited in our theater,
I understand that somehow floating around the sacred precepts of this distinguished seminary, there's a guy named Deppner who was talking about the mission of the church to educated Americans or some such darn thing, and not your racket. I take these people seriously. I think that we have a ministry to those people. and our love for the fact that the theatrical arts, Henry Moore and Pablo Picasso, that this is not popular art. Nor is Tennessee Williams or Samuel Beckett or UNESCO or any of these other camps. It's not popular theater. However, God died for the educated as well as for some of them. Now that's my first thought. But also, I'm impressed by the fact, let's look at popular theater, the Moon Picture. It costs more to produce Moon Picture. You can't produce as much schlock now. And the character, correct me if I'm wrong, you probably go to a lot more movies than I do. I spend all my time talking to people. But it's my own reaction to this type of popular theater that, and I'm not just talking about the foreign production, but it's what comes out of Italy or what comes out of Sweden or what comes out of France. I'm talking about the production out of that mega, that cultural center of the good old U.S. of A., Hollywood. Theater. Real theater. And interestingly enough, it's box office theater, too. Which to me is a matter of encouragement. I always look for hope. I'm like Pollyanna, I suppose. But I take this seriously. The fact that serious movies dealing with what I describe as religious issues of life are produced and make money, which means that people go to see them. And I'm certain they don't go to see them to be titillated or entertaining, because most of the stuff you come out, you know, feel like you've been wrung out. Does this make any sense? Right. And I spend my time, as much time in front of my theater as you do, probably more. Probably more, because now I get to see my videos late at night. I'm becoming an authority on reruns, the late shows. I don't know where I've got time for this, but let's look at a new form of popular theater. The whodunit, the odor, the horse owner. The same plot where sideways, backwards, up and down, but essentially the same. Now, you say essentially. Yeah, sex is here to stay, and I approve of it entirely. But let's move beyond that to some brief appraisal of why the popularity of the odor, why the popularity of the whodunit. This won't bear too close to an evaluation. I think you could possibly assume that it is a form of popular theater, and let's move on from there to the point of departure. In each instance, the plot is just about the same. And the plot has to do, in this age of cultural complexity and ultimate conformity, with a guy strapping symbolically his hog leg to his right thigh, walking down the middle of the street, generally with a beard on his face, acting like a man, taking his destiny in his own hands, as an individual, challenging, confronting a world. Is this too precious for you? Is this one? I don't know. What about the role of women? And that gun smoke, have gun, will travel, and whatever it may be. The woman is fairly stereotyped, but by golly, you know she's a woman. Fragile, tender, has to be lifted into the wagon, have to carry the water bucket or the slops of the hogs or whatever it may be. But in this age of cultural complexity and conformity, with more and more women working, with the gradual breakup of the home, the ambiguity of both male and female roles, here with some clarity and certainty, the odors and the whodunits are re-identifying. Of a type, to be sure, what it is to be a man, what it is to be a woman. One of the more charming things, I just came back
to run a religious emphasis week down at Westminster College, which is a small Presbyterian school down at Fulton. And I should be inured to this by now. It seems that the intent, as you probably remember from your early campus days, the intent of a religion and life week or a religious emphasis week is to kill the guy that's supposed to be the pitchman. You begin at 8 o'clock in the morning, you lecture every hour on the hour up until the time you make a student body presentation and individual appointments in the afternoon, a talk back session, punctuated with those inevitable sessions down at the fraternity house, which couldn't care less, but where you go through the solemn ritual and liturgy of taking mom into the lunchroom, you know, the fraternity house moms, and this goes on for 4 or 5 days, and finally everybody's dead and sick of the whole bit. But I should be inured to the brack sort of sound, because with some consistency, institutions of higher learning seem to employ this particular mode of communication. I'm not exactly sure why. It sounds to me like a critical observation of the academic scene. I'm not certain. Now, I was going to get even more fanciful and whimsical. I have a friend named Kershaw, the Reverend Alvin L. Kershaw, who's also an Episcopal priest, who wants to take all this myth of this truncated pioneer myth of America. You know, you go into the wilderness, dragging your canoe behind you, hacking your way through a wall of solid Indian flesh, and create a brave new land and all this. Well, in a sense, this is what the Western is, sort of a refinement of all this. It's a truncated American myth. But he comes on strong with an appraisal of the granddaddy of all of the odors, which has to do with the Lone Ranger. No, I'm not ashamed of myself. He says a typical Lone Ranger plot goes something like this. That here's some fine, basically decent people that live in what used to be the suburbs of Boston. And with the encroachment of modern civilization, the factories belching smoke, and the bad guys know something that this basically fine, decent, upstanding American family doesn't know. And the bad guys are going to run these characters off. So they first of all start rustling the cattle. Well, these are basically decent Christian people, and they're not going to let a little cattle rustling stand between them and their neighbors. But the bad guys really begin to give them the strong arm. They make threats against the little girl in the family. Now, this is something different. Bone of our bone, flesh of our flesh. We can't stand for this. So we're going to arm all the cowhands, we're going to arm all the cows, and we'll fight these bad guys on their own terms. You know, there comes a point where Christian morality and the Christian ethic just can't work. You've got to play the world's game on the world's own terms. This is a pivotal point in this dramatic little narrative. Now, the forces of law and order, although to be sure, theoretically, they don't like this going on, but they're powerless. What can we do? The sheriff pulls his coat over his badge. The fine, decent people in town, if they offer some assistance, just don't want to be involved because of the risk and the threat to their own security and general euphoria. So they remain disengaged and uninvolved. This is a pivotal point as well. Now, who should come bounding across the moors to be the deliverer of this occasion? Save the Lone Ranger. Now, the Lone Ranger, says Kershaw in his whimsical mind, and his associates, bear some bit of investigation and consideration. The Lone Ranger wears a mask, and you never know who he is. He comes to be incognito. But he always has a sign by which he may be known. Fairly good New Testament theology, isn't he? He has a sign. But even though he has a sign, people don't recognize him for who he is and for what he is coming. He's held in suspicion, mistrust, and it's not only the bad guys he's fearing, but the good guys as well. So he is a loner. He does the best he can all by himself, but with good old Tonto. Now, who is Tonto? Tonto is a member of a despised and rejected minority. That's fairly good Old Testament and New Testament theology, isn't it? So anyhow, the Lone Ranger and Tonto start to go to work on doing something about the sick situation. But the bad guys get the drop on them and throw them down a mine shaft, an abandoned mine shaft to be true, sure, and pour in behind them, a powder keg with a long scroll fuse running up to the surface. And they light the fuse, and the fuse goes sputtering and guttering down to blow Tonto and the Lone Ranger to kingdom come, and thus, when this is done, good will have been removed.
will no longer be a threat to the world. Now, the bad guys build a fire and break out the red eye and start to have a couple of belts while they're waiting for this demise of the Savior to be accomplished. What they don't know, and this is where the theology of this Lone Ranger gets in, what they don't know is that the Lone Ranger and Tonto discover a rock, they tie loose in the back end of the mine shaft, and they get out. And about the time everything goes boom, and the bad guys begin to rejoice in the destruction of good, the Lone Ranger and Tonto sneak around and get the drop on them and tie them up and take them back to town. Well, when they show to the townspeople, to the marshals, to the magistrates, that evil is led forth kept in captivity, then the marshal proudly displays his badge again. The magistrate has a new sense of the dignity of his office, and the people have a new sense of freedom to act upon the basic, decent structure of laws by which they would order their society and their government. And everybody rejoices. Life can go on in some kind of creative kind of community again. Evil has been put to death. We have a savior. And about the time that they're in the process of all this rejoicing, somebody says, "Who was that?" And the Lone Ranger goes galloping across the plains to the ineffective meetings of the Louisiana William Tell Overture. Somebody says in all tones, "Didn't you know that was the Lone Ranger?" A Christ event? I don't know. But it's no accident, it seems to me, that within the myth, within the residual religious Christian understandings of the people of this civilization, this American culture, that enough of it remains so that it's not on the basis of seeing the same old hackneyed kind of plot, the horse opera. It's not for sensual titillation, but rather out of a cultural memory of the fact that this is what the myth of this folk is all about. It's fairly decent, with some noticeable loopholes, some fairly decent incarnational theology. How do you react to that? Enough said. Silence sometimes is more eloquent than words. Yes, sir.
I was just wondering, I know the individual theorists, now, how many of them would incorporate this type of thinking themselves, or would it just be something rather subconscious which they would experience in their lives?
This is the man, and maybe this is the man who can talk to you about cultural memory and all this kind of stuff. I don't know. But what I'm saying is that you have to consider this kind of thing as a Christian apologist, as a communicator of the values of faith, very seriously as a means of establishing communication and relevant dialogue with the people of our time. It's interesting to me with this transparent kind of Sandlin Lone Ranger there. But people understand this, and there are a lot of aha's. Yes.
Sounds like somewhat Ukrainian in regards to all this is that, as with modern drama, the value for it to us as Christians in our proclamation is not so much in what is going on in itself, but in what we can do afterwards with it in the form of dialogue we're talking about.
I suppose that's what I'm saying. That's a very good summation. A means of establishing dialogue, a means of establishing communication. Communication, that's another little word, Teddy. I've been giving that start for a little bit. Anything that I'll get there will be something more. Communication. Communicare, we all know about that. We all know about the play off the ring changes on the community, communion, communism. Holy Communion, we could bring all kinds of changes on there. Mm-hmm. Somebody pointed out to me the other day, John, that this word and its ultimate origin has to do with communis, with arms, like armamentarium, like the whole armor of God and what Paul has to say about swords and breastplates and all this other kind of stuff. In a real sense, Christianity has got to discover what its effective armamentarium is in fighting the sin, the world, and the devil. And one of the most effective, I'm just repeating myself, but the most effective armamentarium of the Christian apologist would be communicators is the art, whether in their popular, their basic, and most popular manifestations, like the videos. And there's some good stuff on television as well. Real good stuff being written in commission for television. There's watching. And I'm impressed by the fact that people are watching. 16 to 20 million people. If you were to preach to a congregation of 1,000, which you won't, nor will I, for the rest of your life, you wouldn't preach to, I then can't do the mathematics, but I'm staggered by this. This is something that people look at, see, and perhaps to some degree remember. This is armamentarium, I say, for the Christian community. The question is whether we in our time have a capacity, I know we have the necessity, but whether we have the capacity to depart from time-honored, classical, formalized, charismatic proclamations of the faith, to experiment, to explore new modes of communication by which we and some people may identify some common concerns and issues emerging out of the context of human life, through which the truths of faith, the sacramental ministry of the church, the revelation of God through scripture, and whatever, may be functionally relevant to the living of a life, the organizing of life around some core of values, upon some principle of loyalty, which men can share in the community, about which they can communicate. This seems to be the issue.
When you say we have the capacity, do you mean that will our community accept this sort of thing, or do we actually have the ability to put into drama the things which are theologically oriented?
Well, life is theological. It's theological, it's all get out. Our job, it seems to me, is to assist some people via perhaps means of, is one illustration, means that I've suggested, to do some theologizing, to engage in some dialogic theologizing. That's a great phrase. That's my own conviction, that people have a great sense of urgency within them to do some theologizing, if they are assisted to do so. And oftentimes I think that instead of standing up and doing a real neat, valid, earnest job of charismatic proclamation, expository preaching, that by far the more effective thing that I could do is to begin to talk to some people about streetcar named Desire, end game, waiting for the goal, in order to say that we together may begin to identify where the pinch of life is. What are the questions that people out of their humanity are giving expression to? Nothing.
So what are these questions? I think it is third point as the title to what we've said here. What are the questions you ask of these media? I take it that you believe that they are asking questions of the media. What are the questions that will help us discover what we're saying in the spirit area of the religion?
It's to take, I'm talking out of the context of the art, to take the art seriously, to take them seriously. Well, they're certainly performed, created seriously. Not arbitrarily, not whimsically. They're not created by some the hermit Dave that's been living back in his cave and he pops out in the year 1962 with a picture or a play or whatever it may be to sort of throw at some people and dust back in. No, he's living in the midst of a company of people about himself as an individual, and so it is to be presumed about the people with whom he shares, whatever type of community is being shared, he must, out of a sense of urgency and passion and conviction and anguish, say something, speak, hold up before them, a symbol that confronts them and says, this is the question. This is how I see you. This is how I see me. This is how I understand it. And it's all more often than not in the way of an articulation of a question. But this is the beginning of all religious communication. It all begins with a question. What must I do to be saved? This is fairly good New Testament theology, as a matter of fact. And from what and under what?
Well, you would say after that we have a less secular society than some religious community.
No, we have an overly secular society. And I say that it's time for the church to take the world seriously. For the church to take the world seriously. The world's arts, the world's economics, the world's industry, the world's sociology, it takes the world seriously. The communications that emerge from the very secularity of life, which are being beamed somewhere, like by men like this, to whom? To God? To other men? To the church? I don't know. But being beams seriously, passionately, but takes the world seriously, and the world's communication. Communication is always two ways. It's not from the church, but that's the Lord, but it's communication between the church and the world. I suppose this is what I'm trying to say, not very well, to be sure. Yes, sir.
Well, it seems to me that this vote would be needed. I mean, the very real thing to look at would be thus saith the Lord, I mean, maybe not in such a dynamic way. I mean, yes, you can argue about that. In a way that both, I think, are necessary. I mean, the two-way communication of drama, so to speak, or for that of just oral speaking. I mean, I can see where you would need a definite, more clear spelling out of God's message to man from the pulpit, just as you would need perhaps the drama to spell out in more detail the intimate relationship which you will put in mind.
This is true. But let me point out something else. Again, out of the repertoire of popular American theater, not fairly. Words, words, words! We're great on the word, the proclamation of the word, which we generally see, the verbal symbol to describe an experience that somebody, perhaps even I, have had. But this doesn't necessarily guarantee communication. Back in the miasma of semantics, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, John Scholes, all that. As I check out Logos theology and attempt to come to terms with what, who this Word is, it sounds suspiciously to me like it's not verbality or a description of the experiences of the people of the ancient church or even my own personal experiences. It is not a verbal description of something, but rather as a philosophical principle or a theological symbol or whatever, however you choose to think, consider word capital W. It looks to me suspiciously like what they're talking about in the prologue to John is the word in its action, the act. And the beginning was the act, an action. Couple this to what that square that old Dutchman up in the Harvard Yard, Chilich is always talking about, the recovery of the depth dimension of a man's life, or the vagina, or he's talking about the multidimensional nature of man, that he's more than intellect, or Will Herburn does a great job with this over the Drew Seminary, which is worthy of your reading and thoughtful ponder, that man is multiform, various, complex. He is multidimensional. And in the unceasing warfare between his cortex and his viscera, that his viscera wins out most of the time. And oftentimes, I suspect that our communication, our most earnest efforts at communication, are aimed right between his eyes. Whereas, more appropriately, they should be aimed at his gut.
Yes. Would be part of this be remedied by making our message more concrete and using more concrete terms in terms of everyday situations. I mean, because the person can sort of visualize the situation in concrete terms, this would, I think, help him to see the matter more clearly.
Yeah, perhaps.
I mean, you can't do as much.
Maybe
as
somebody back here is going to help both of you and me.
No, I'm going to ask them. But we've got to the point here where we're saying that Peter is asking questions. He's asking questions that modern man is asking. Now, we're saying that the church has got to come up with some answers. Now, and evidently, you say the church is not answering these questions effectively. What do you advocate? What kind of the church needs to do some of these art forms? And what do you feel in concrete terms we can do?
I would say that perhaps Lutheran, but most of the people I talk to would understand it, but I even have to ask the question. For instance, the varied realm of architecture. God is a God who moves. He's not a static God. One concretized, and the revelation of God was not concretized in 1519, nor at any subsequent period or time prior to.
God is a God who moves. Everything that has to do with the church, her rites, usages, liturgy, her attempts to communicate, her architecture, her music, the rest, communicates some understanding that the people of the church have in regard to the nature of the faith enterprise in which they embark. If the Christ is the ever-contemporaneous Christ, it seems to me that the church is well advised to consider new voices and voicings for the articulation of the ancient truths of faith to which the liturgy and the church's doctrine and theology attest. I bring up architecture because I thought where I grew up and out of the tradition from which I emerged, a church didn't look like a church unless it was a nice piece of a slavish Gothic or Georgian replica with a steeple on the church and some fake flying buttresses and all this kind of business. The very houses, the places in which we worship, says something important, communicates non-verbally, to be sure, which communicates non-verbally about what this folk are up to, what they understand themselves to be and to be for. It's no accident that we who have liturgical churches appoint our churches in such a way, not only in regard to geographical orientations and layouts, but in terms of the thaumaturgia that with which we appoint our churches. A good case in point, I'm not sure whether I see some of you guys down at my 5:30 service from time to time in the chapel of Christ Church Cathedral. The hottest issue at the Christ Church Cathedral right now, which is the center of Episcopalianism in the diocese in this area, is the cross. If you haven't seen it, I hope that you will go to see it because it's worth a trip. It looks something like this to me. And if the cross, traditionally, symbolically, is a matter of offense, this is good New Testament theology, then it must be an offense in every age. And into a certain, unescapable sense, it must be artistically offensive. It must be communicatively offensive, as is this cross down here. Because it's fairly certain to me that Christianity is not sort of an arbitrary cultural grab bag intent upon pouring holy water on the status quo, but rather it stands for something. And the mission of the church stands for something enduringly through the ages. And in terms of this cross, which in a basic Greek cross kind of form, I don't think it would spoil it for you. And here are two panels that depict the families of our day and age, and up here to complete a missionary cross, Jerusalem missionary cross, there are four small plaques with some very depth artwork done on them, which under forms that you will investigate, I hope, talk about the ancient Greek categories of earth, air, fire, and water, the very ingredients of life and the created order. And within on these arms of the cross are other panels that depict the style of life that we're living, relevant to our politics, our recreation, our industry, our culture, our academic pursuits, and the rest. What is this kind of communication ultimately resulting in? It says that within this cross, the whole of life is embodied. Around this cross as a source of value. This is nonverbal communication. Life is to be interpreted, to be made sense of, to be lived by. This is just one example. But there are other examples all over the spot, all over the life, architecturally, the graphic and the plastic art, musically. This is one of my own particular hobbies. I hope this will develop a good hobby sometime and ride it hard. It gives you something to do, keep you off the street sometimes. My own hobby is jazz. And I say quite seriously that on the basic premise that the church must discover new voices and voices for the communication of ancient truths to which the liturgy of the church attests, that jazz is a contemporary voice. I've written a jazz mass, the Kyrie, the Sanctus, the Agnus Dei, the Joining Celtic. I hope that sometime
I was going to say your lesbian committee, but that admit, that's another
what do you call it over here? Not the Sassians, Lyceum.
I hope that maybe, because maybe not so much within Missouri Synod Lutheranism, but United Lutheranism, there's some very interesting experiments are going on in this area. Very seriously taken, as I take mine very seriously. I hope that your Lyceum would let me and the St. Louis Jazz Quintet come over and do this for you sometime, for you to think about it. I have a lust for effective communication. I hope that you will have a corresponding lust. The reason I have it is because I have so often found myself boxed in out of a sense of, I don't know what, you know the song, Who Put the Overalls in Mrs. Murphy's Chowder? Nobody answers, boy, yells a little louder. This is what I have found myself doing over and over again. Yelling the same old things in the same old kind of way as some people who in most instances couldn't care less. Yes. I don't run this show. I just work here.
Slipping in before this question, comment on these, which might have been your partial answer to the question on what do we say, what do you advocate, and then the question? And then we'll knock off about 5 minutes here.
Yeah, you all, I think, are, I don't know, what do you want to say? You said, these just happen to be some self-conscious religious plays that are being produced. And when they talk about G-O-D, they're talking about, to some extent, the same kind of G-O-D that we're talking about out of our own faith understanding. Yes.
I don't know where you're
leading
us now. I wonder,
are there something that's being
theologian?
I knew one of you smart aleck theologians is going to pick this up. I think that they are with earnestness.
Yeah, my own
with earnestness.
I'm here maybe with the first in line, is the Egyptian.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that the ultimate resolution of both sides is that our G-O-D is rejected.
God's a lot bigger than you and me, and God is a lot bigger than any particular formulations that you or I may have inherited or concocted in order to give a description of G-O-D. And I have to take these guys seriously. I have to take them real seriously. And one of the reasons I have to, probably the most basic reason, an important reason I have to take them seriously, is that they're in most instances communicating with some people relevantly about the content, meaning of G-O-D than I am.
Yeah, no, I was more or less trying to do that last time. I can follow all of this you're saying about communication and the hookup with modern man in terms of what kind of desire is, what have you. But it still seems when we get deep, but if you're self-consciously religious, and I don't want to generalize, but particularly say it's J.D. and Goodman, the ultimate conclusion is very much the same as a conclusion to a recurring desire or to a death of self, except that it involves God or a figure that. But in J.D., what's the resolution? The resolution is still that man has to find salvation within himself, unless I read it wrong. And with many of these self-consciously religious plays, it seems that there's still an active which is really no, basically no difference.
You know what one of our problems is as Christians? We don't take the incarnation seriously. We really don't. The resolution of J.B., blow on the coal of the heart, and we'll know by and by. You know, people reaching out and putting arms around each other, trying to perform loving motions as best they can. Maybe it's fanciful in me. I really take the incarnation seriously. I don't think a person can write this unless over his shoulder there's some basic understanding that the truth about man and his hope is rooted and grounded in the central fact of the incarnation, which is the pivotal point of all human hope and striving.
But still, even if you can see this, it seems to me they don't allow enough for the vertical to go to the horizontal. The horizontal may be true or maybe real important. And it may be real important to blow on the cold real hard.
Yeah, but you see, our job is, when we can establish some dialogue with somebody that takes JB seriously, and we're talking about the truth, and the JB thing is the truth of this, then perhaps we can go one step further. I get impatient with people that don't use my language, that don't use my symbols, that don't talk my brand of theology, that don't function out of the same doctrinal setup that I do. But if all I'm doing is saying you're wrong, then there's no possibility for dialogue. If I can meet people where they are in their own groupings and strivings, then perhaps the resultant dialogue may make it possible for them to listen to me.
And you're saying that something like this has gone one step beyond the streetcar and desire.
A streetcar is, well, yes. You read Night of the Iguana, by the way? This is kind of interesting. I think it's interesting to watch Williams when he's off the psychiatrist's couch sort of groping towards something, in the same way that it's interesting to watch Albert Camus groping towards something. In the same way that it's most interesting for me to watch J.D. Salinger groping towards something, finding the distinction between the catcher and Finian Zue. I find this exciting. And what else I find, and it's not just because I hit a lot of college camp pie, or some fairly literate people, but because I find people taking these books seriously and theologizing out of the content of these plays and these books or these art forms in a way that I can't make it possible for them to sit down and theologize with me about Pauline epistles to save my neck. I chopped off somebody back here. Take a look at Cocktail Party, T.S. Eliot. That's another one. I put it up in the explicit rather than the implicitly with Christian kind of plays. I think we're always in such a big galloping sweat to get everything resolved, tied up, get everybody converted, get everybody in the institutional church. I think we do ourselves and our Lord a great disservice oftentimes in this manner. I say that before there can be a resolution, people must be assisted to take the living of life seriously. And I say that the arts perform us as Christian apologists an invaluable service in assisting, almost compelling, people to reappraise the meaning, purpose, worth, direction, and destiny of their lives.
Kenneth Carmichael, that's the last thing I'll do in about 10 minutes, so we really appreciate the time you've given.
Thank
and
you, Joel.
We can have you back for a continuing.